Mark Bauerlein, a professor of English from Emory University, has a problem with American college students. They are losing the capacity to read. He blames computers, and he argues further that the free and easy access provided by computers is sapping students' initiative as well. Last year, he required his students to obtain obituaries of famous writers without using the internet. The students' response was to stare in confusion. They did not know what to do. But starting with the basics, has our reading capacity declined as we have drifted from the printed page to the screen? Now, Bauerlein cites extensive research by Jacob Nielsen to say, yes, it has. So what precisely did Nielsen discover about on-screen reading habits?
Well, one of the things that Nielsen did in his many, many research studies of web usage and web reading was use something called eye-tracking technology. These are machines that are able to follow your eyes as they move across the page, and they kind of chart how long and in which direction the eyes move. And so he's able to follow hundreds of people as they go through different websites and surf and browse and so on. And what he found was this strange F pattern that showed up. People get to the top of the screen and they read all the way across, somewhat linearly, word by word. But as they go down the page, their horizontal movement shortens and their vertical movement quickens. There's a little bit of a pause around the middle of the page. That makes that smaller F horizontal line. But then when they get to the bottom, they're almost reading entirely vertically. And Nielsen's advice is, if you have any important web content, don't put it in the lower right-hand corner of the screen.
In fact, he issued an alert a decade ago, and he was entitled How Users Read on the Web. And his report opened bluntly, they don't.
They don't. They skim. They browse. They pick up keywords, and they look for visuals and bullet points. And the point that he draws from all of this is when people go to the web, they're looking for something, and they have a pretty good idea of what they want. And they're not interested in beautiful language. They're not interested in nice metaphors, nice prose, you know, artistic presentations. They're interested in the piece of information, the nugget that they want. And this really fashions a cognitive habit. When you're talking about kids from the age of five who have been learning through this tool, again, ever since their minds really started forming intellectually, that's how they look upon this material. It's information to retrieve. It's not really knowledge to internalize. It's, I got a question. I need to provide an answer for it. I'm going to go to Google, I'm going to type in those search terms, I'm going to find what I want really fast, cut and paste it, print it out, and give it back. And that's really the process for them of education. That's the extension into the classroom. It's information retrieval, it's not knowledge formation.
And this is why you say that after huge investments U.S. schools have made in computer technology, the returns have been very meager.
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is ever since roughly 1996, with a big piece of legislation passed in Congress and signed by President Clinton, every single phone bill, the monthly phone bill for every phone, cell phones, landlines, contains a federal tax. Everyone pays into a great big kitty that goes toward wiring schools for internet access. It's been going on for a long time, billions of dollars to get more internet, more computers, more laptops into schools. So an enormous investment. And when we look at the learning gains, reading scores, flat. SAT scores, these are like college entrance examinations, those have actually gone down. Another college entrance examination, the ACT scores, those went down this year. More and more students going to college end up in remedial reading and writing courses. These are courses in which students have to go into because they can't handle college-level work. So they're learning things in these remedial courses that they should have learned in high school. Corporate America now spends $3.1 billion a year on remedial reading and writing training for its own employees. And a lot of you know, middle managers and human resources people say, I can't believe the younger employees we have in our workplace. The emails they write aren't even grammatical. How did these kids graduate from school? I pinpoint a lot of this to all the texting, the blogging, the posting, the uploading and downloading, all of the kinds of social communication, social networking the kids spend enormous hours doing on their own time.
Because you see the problem is that when you add laptops to schools, what kids are doing is they're bringing their leisure time reading habits to class. That's the problem, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the teachers, they see, wow, a whole new laptop, brand new spanking, glistening screens in my room, and they're on all the tables. I've got my master control there up front, and they think that it is an amazing advent. But, you know, kids have been looking at these things for years, and again, in their own time, in their bedrooms. We have multimedia centers, and they are sitting in their bedrooms at midnight with the laptop flipped open, and they're chatting with buddies up and down the street and across the country. They're doing a new blog post, and most of the blogs in the United States are kept by teenagers. And they're writing about their schools. They're writing about how much they love their friends or how much they hate their classmates. They're posting pictures from the party last week, talking about what happened in the cafeteria that morning. It's very much oriented around peer-to-peer contact. And the language is crude. The thoughts and sentiments are puerile and adolescent. Kids will be kids. And what the internet has done is empower them to expand all these inclinations 24/7. It's all teen discourse all the time.
And, of course, with Facebook and YouTube, I mean, you're saying the problem isn't necessarily the content, but, again, it's the reading styles that are employed here.
It's fast. If you stand behind a 16-year-old in the library going through the screens, man, those screens go by boom, 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 boom. Listen to them hit the keyboard to type out those emails and text messages. It's like a machine gun pace. And this acceleration of language processing, it is very useful for certain activities. If you want to write a quick note to someone, if you want to find a quick piece of information. But when it comes time to write a coherent, logical paragraph filled with, you know, nice descriptive vocabulary, when it comes time to analyze a dense philosophical argument or a difficult modernist poem, these kind of slow reading, slow writing activities, they break down. They can't do them. Remember, we're talking about thousands and thousands of hours online grooving the fast habits. And this doesn't make them flexible so that they can somehow do a slow reading and writing habit when the time comes. No, they always like it fast. They want it that way. Looking closely at the verbal surface, pondering the ideas contained in difficult texts, that's irritating. They don't like it.
You state a handheld screen makes different cognitive demands from, say, Madame Bovary, but this is not being recognized by advocates of e-learning, is it?
No. The advocates of e-learning love all the new tools and the so-called new skills that are being developed and the new literacies that are being developed. And I keep asking them, what new skills are you talking about? I mean, when college professors surveyed in the United States said by a 2-to-1 vote, students are worse on basic skills and knowledge than they were 10 years ago, that's not strong evidence in your favor. When only 6% of college teachers said that students coming into their classes are, quote, very well prepared in writing, that doesn't support your position very strongly. So what are the skills that you're talking about here? And they sort of break down, and they really don't have a strong response to that. But they have a tremendous amount of momentum and a lot of money behind them. There's a huge push to digitalize every space you possibly can on a college campus. The future is technology. This is the banner that we keep hearing. And, you know, everyone feels they have history with a capital H on their side. And the people who doubt it, the skeptics, well, we're just pegged as Luddites and reactionaries and not realizing that the world has passed us by.
You're listening to Counterpoint on ABC Radio National. We're talking to Mark Bauerlein, Professor of English at Emory University. His latest book is The Dumbest Generation: How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. That's a pretty confronting title for a book, Mark. What's some of the responses you've got?
It's kind of a harsh title. It's kind of mean-spirited. And so people say, you know, why did you do that? I was going to dedicate the book to my wife. She saw that title and said, I want my name to go underneath that title. And I understood. But, you know, what I've seen, first of all, about a provocative title like that is teaching sometimes works best by support and encouragement and care and inspiration. But sometimes teaching also works best by challenge and criticism and provocation. And you need to mix them given the circumstances. And when I see between classes on university campuses that more than half of the students are racing from one building to another, but they got their eyes focused on that cell phone screen, or they got the cell phone to their ears to try to listen and hear and see what kind of messages came through in the last 45 minutes that they must check before they get to their next class, I think we're in the realm of challenge and provocation. So yes. That's the reason behind that title.
Well, it certainly got me. Now, speaking of teaching challenges, you've written about even better students have problems with attentive reading, as you found with one of your introduction to poetry classes. What happened there?
Well, you know, I often have students memorize poems and then recite them in the class. And I left academia for a few years, and I worked in the U.S. federal government in a research office where I did some of the initial research for the book. I came back 3 years later in 2006, and I remember stating to an introduction to poetry class, okay, this week's assignment, you're going to memorize 20 lines of verse of your own choosing, and you're going to recite them to the class. And a young student in front said, why? And she wasn't being impudent. She wasn't saying, no, I won't do this. She genuinely didn't understand, why would we want to memorize a poem? And it took me a while to realize what was going on there. One, well, why memorize a poem? I can always get it with a couple of double clicks. It's always there if I need it. Two, everything that she has done with words on her own time for the last few years, again, is fast reading, quick word processing, responding to buddies back and forth. Memorization slows you down. You have to ponder the verbal surface very carefully. You got all the prepositions in the right place. All the pauses and the intonations have to be correct. And that simply works against something that she has been grooving for 12 years. So it just is the kind of habit that didn't make sense to her. And I think that that's regrettable, because these kinds of mental exercises of memorization, working with language, they discipline the mind. They improve the memory. Memory is a muscle. You've got to use it or you lose it. They build your vocabulary, and also they force you to assume another voice, to get inside, to imagine another character than yourself.
Mark Bauerlein is Professor of English at Emory University, and for more details on that story, you can check out our website.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.